This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It is absolutely crucial to end the addiction to fossil fuels.
That's United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on the need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere. Details coming up. Also, the six-day truce between Israel and Hamas is scheduled to end in a few hours without an extension. And Doctors Without Borders says too little is being done to protect vulnerable people from climate change. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the COP28 climate summit gets underway in Dubai Thursday. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the meeting comes at what scientists say is a crucial moment in the fight against global warming, with warnings the world is on the brink of irreversible and catastrophic climate change.
Scientists expect 2023 to go down as the hottest year on record. Fearsome heat, forest fires and flash storms have characterized a year of extreme weather around the world. Against that urgent backdrop, 70,000 delegates from 197 nations gather in Dubai for the two-week COP28 climate summit beginning Thursday. Observers call it a crucial moment. Tom Rivett Carnac is a former strategist at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
This is the launch of what's called the global stocktake. So this is the first time since the Paris Agreement the world has taken stock of how are we doing on the objectives we set ourselves back then. And it's challenging to see what that report says. We should be reducing our emissions by 43% by the end of this decade. The latest trajectory suggests they're actually going to rise by 9%, with catastrophic impacts for people all over the world.
The COP summits involve complex negotiations. Most countries want to reduce global emissions. Less developed nations say richer nations are responsible for most historic greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore they should compensate poorer nations for reducing their use of fossil fuels. Poorer nations also need help to adapt to the changing climate. Again, Tom Rivett Carnac.
Last year, the big outcome was a commitment to create a fund for loss and damage for those impacts that we can't avoid. What we need to see this year is that that fund takes another step towards becoming reality.
The Paris Agreement aims to limit global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2050. Visiting Antarctica this month, where the ice is now melting three times faster than in the 1990s, the United Nations Secretary General said the culprit was clear.
It is absolutely crucial to end the addiction to fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are the first source of climate change. And I hope that the next COP will be able to decide the phase out of fossil fuels with a clear time frame that is compatible to guarantee that the temperature will not rise more than 1.5 degrees.
The leaders of the world's two biggest economies, US President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, agreed to deepen cooperation on climate change during talks in November. Former UN strategist Tom Rivett Carnac.
What you see is that if the US and China are in lockstep and have a clear sense of what they want to achieve together, it's much easier for the world to come together around those commitments.
However, a US official said this week that President Biden would not be attending the COP28 talks. No reason was given. US climate envoy John Kerry will be leading day-to-day negotiations for the United States. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Doctors Without Borders, known as MSF, says too little is being done to protect vulnerable people from the negative impacts of climate change. Caroline Voot, MSF's climate and environmental health strategic lead, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that more failure on cutting greenhouse gas emissions is not an option for places like South Sudan, where increasing temperatures, lack of basic services, and conflict have caused a climate, health and humanitarian emergency.
I think for MSF, we work mostly in settings that are considered humanitarian contexts, so where you need a specific assistance outside of what normal systems can provide, either at country level or sub-country level, and where we specifically focus on medical assistance in these settings. So this tends to be for people who are unwell or needing a specific medical care in a humanitarian context, so de facto would be vulnerable. You can also decline that further into shall we say, people that fall into particularly vulnerable categories. If you're talking about extreme heat, then you're going to be talking about people who are older or who work outside or overly exposed. And in this case, we're talking about people who kind of sit at the intersect of many of these things, individuals who might be already kind of more vulnerable from the fact that they are living in countries that are overexposed to the impacts of climate change. In addition to that, people who would be then living in countries like that, that are also having to, you know, survive in humanitarian contexts where they are facing different types of emergencies, be they conflict or otherwise, where they require additional assistance outside of what systems can provide or because systems no longer function, and so on and so forth.
In 2023, you mentioned one of the places MSF has had to respond to and other groups are the consequences of such climate events in South Sudan with the flooding. There's been flooding in other African countries, too. That was a big problem in 2023, right?
Yes. Essentially, what we're seeing at the moment and what the science has predicted and what we have also begun to see in just the operating environments where we are and what people have to deal with is that we're dealing with more frequent occurrences of catastrophic events or of crises, and we're dealing with them at greater scales for longer periods of time, and we're dealing with them one after the other, if not concurrently. So the phrase that we're using most often right now is polycrisis, because it's always several things at once, and there's never really a time for a break for people.
And that's got to make it hard for Doctors Without Borders and other groups that are just trying to meet all these and address all these needs of people who are really in dire circumstances. And then you get this kind of burnout, I suppose, with donors.
Yeah, if you take the example of South Sudan, South Sudan has many different things that need a particular response. If you look at the humanitarian side of the equation, it already needed a certain amount of humanitarian assistance to cover the consequences, for instance, of chronic conflict in certain areas, as well as specific needs that are in addition to what the system can support, be that malaria or malnutrition or something like that. Then in addition to that, you are having an increased number of increased frequency of extreme flood events, which we've been seeing over several years and culminating also this year. And at a certain point, it's not, I mean, there is a donor fatigue, yes. I think the important thing is that people often, when you are working with institutions that would be supporting ministries of health or would be supporting preventive care through water and sanitation services, things like that, fatigue, yes, in terms of supporting action in these environments, because it feels like there's never an end in sight or never a solution in sight. Or a lot of these financiers, and I think this is actually a big issue on the climate side of the equation, are not sufficiently flexible to work in settings like this.
That's Caroline Voot, MSF's climate and environmental health strategic lead. She was speaking with VOA's Kyle Van Dam from London.
Around the world, people are marking the United Nations 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Help us mark the work to end violence against women by sharing your thoughts on VOA's English to Africa radio programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076 before December 10th. Tell us what is being done in your community to fight gender-based violence and tell us why this issue is important to you. That number again is +1 202 258 3076.
Today, China presented a four-point plan for Middle East peace in the United Nations Security Council. Foreign Minister Wang Yi told the council the war shows the need for a Palestinian state alongside Israel. The Security Council is meeting in New York hours before a truce in Gaza expires. International mediators are working to extend the six-day truce, which has allowed the release of militant held hostages and Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. So far, Hamas has freed 81 of the more than 240 hostages taken on October 7th, when Hamas and allied militants attacked Israeli communities. In turn, Israel has released more than 150 Palestinians held in its prisons. It also has allowed more aid and fuel into the Gaza Strip, which has been under blockade since October 7th. Also today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said President Joe Biden's administration would like to see the ceasefire extended to secure the release of more hostages and to ramp up humanitarian aid deliveries to Gaza. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas is calling for an international conference to resolve the conflict. He said today the Palestinians are ready to work with the international community on a serious political process that leads to an independent state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. The Israel Defense Forces today said it is investigating a Hamas report that a 10-month-old Israeli hostage, his 4-year-old brother, and their mother were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. A short time ago, I spoke with journalist Linda Grandstein in Jerusalem on the latest developments. So what is being said there about another possible extension to the ceasefire?
Well, both Israel and Hamas seem to be interested in extending that ceasefire. And Israel originally said that it was interested in extending it for, you know, another few days, as long as Hamas continues to release hostages. At the beginning, in fact, Israel came out with a list of 300 Palestinian prisoners who could be released. At the same time, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel does intend to go back to the fighting after that ceasefire ends. And in something that really just happened, the army says it's checking a claim by Hamas that one family, a father, a mother, and two very young kids, 10 months and 4 years old, who had been in Hamas captivity, and apparently Hamas had turned them over to another faction, that they had been killed. And there's no confirmation yet, but these two little boys, both, I think I even mentioned them yesterday, carrot-topped, red-headed boys, have become somehow symbols of all of the children who had been held in captivity. And so if this does turn out to be true, there's going to be a lot of anger and sadness in Israel.
President Joe Biden's administration would like to see a new extension of the ceasefire. And the official, you know, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected to arrive in Israel, I think, today. And also the United States Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, Roger Cranston, is heading that way. So is pressure building up from the American side to kind of, make the ceasefire lasting?
Well, I think there is pressure, but Israel insists that it won't give in to that pressure. Israel says that the longest the ceasefire can last would be 10 days. So that would mean, you know, another 4 days after today, and that then Israel's committed to going back to the fighting. There definitely will be pressure, but what Israeli officials are saying is that if they stop the fighting now, basically that would leave Hamas in power in Gaza. And then the next round of fighting is just a matter of time, whether it's 2 years or 5 years, that Hamas will rearm, will get together. At the same time, given the fact that about 15,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed and the humanitarian crisis that's been created and that half of the homes in Gaza, in northern Gaza, have been destroyed, the United States is very worried about an ongoing, you know, humanitarian crisis. I think they're at least pressuring Israel that if it does resume the fighting, to make sure that there are safe zones in the south of Gaza that Palestinians can flee to and to stay safe. But if it does go into southern Gaza, as Israeli officials keep saying they intend to do, it's going to be very difficult to avoid civilian casualties.
And talking about humanitarian crisis, the World Health Organization is warning diseases such as respiratory infections and diarrheal diseases may kill more people than the fighting in Gaza.
Yes, there's definitely concern. Look, even before this war started, Gaza is one of the poorest areas in the world. It's densely populated. There isn't good hygiene. Even before the war, the World Health Organization was saying that some 95% of the water wasn't drinkable. Now, given everything that's happened, there really is a humanitarian crisis, and people are living in very difficult conditions. All of the UN schools and shelters are completely packed, something like 9 times the amount of people that they're supposed to have. I've spoken to people in Gaza who say there's 4 working toilets for 10,000 people. So, you know, the international community is going to have to, you know, put in huge amounts of money and is going to have to work very quickly to try to prevent the kinds of things you were talking about.
So is aid entering Gaza?
Yes, aid is entering Gaza, but there's such a backlog. You know, for 50 days, very little aid was getting in. And so there is water, enough, there seems to be enough water, but in terms of medicines, in terms of cooking oil, I spoke to someone in Gaza yesterday who told me they were cooking on wooden stoves because there was no cooking fuel. Now that's getting in, but it's also not clear how quickly it's being distributed. In other words, what kind of mechanism is there to see that flour and rice and these staples are getting to the people who need them? And it's the situation in Gaza is so chaotic. And for example, UN officials say that, you know, they've lost dozens of UN workers in Israeli airstrikes. So it's really hard to imagine how this humanitarian crisis is going to be solved.
Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence campaign is in full swing, running through December 10th, which is Human Rights Day. The campaign was started by activists at the inauguration of the Women's Global Leadership Institute in 1991 and has been used as an organizing strategy ever since to call for preventing and eliminating of violence against women and girls. Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam there's been some progress in reducing trafficking of women globally, but he says people should look at the problem with a wider lens.
I think one of the most important things about human trafficking is to think beyond law enforcement, is to think of it more as a human rights abuse and not just as a crime against individuals. Don't think only about the victims, but the victimized, the populations, groups that are particularly vulnerable and are vulnerable for certain reasons, because that tells you where you can make progress. And so I think that's been probably the most important accomplishment in previous years, is to help broaden the mindset about what is the nature of human trafficking and what happens to people in it and who is vulnerable to it, because that then helps you develop programs and solutions to help end it.
Who is vulnerable?
Well, everyone, actually. Many people think of it as a problem of the poor, and that's true to an extent. Mostly poor people are trafficked, but not all poor people are trafficked. So it's poverty plus something. And this is where we look at the particular vulnerabilities for women and for girls. So, for example, inequitable education, girls not getting training in school beyond, say, elementary school, or a lack of money for small business and microenterprise development. Something as simple in certain countries as not having inheritance rights. Who inherits money in terms of whether that inequitably deals with women being able to save and pass money to daughters and on through other generations.
I know that in some African cultures, traditions, that just doesn't happen. It's not passed on to the women, right?
True, yes. I mean, so some of this is cultural in terms of something where certain societies have patriarchy and some have matriarchy. And so when you have those situations where only men or boys can inherit, then that kind of disempowers women, and that creates an economic vulnerability. And so when you think of all the things that make women vulnerable to all of the kind of social inequities that we see throughout Africa and throughout developing countries, trafficking is similar. It's a symptom of these inequities.
And trafficking isn't just, you know, isolated to certain countries like that. It's happening everywhere, including the United States, right?
True. It's in every country and almost in every part of every country throughout Africa and throughout the world. But what's interesting is to look, if you dig beyond the statistics, there are 50 million people around the world in what the United Nations calls modern forms of slavery. 28 million of that is forced labor. 22 million of that is forced marriage. The forced marriage side of it particularly affects women and girls much more so than men and boys. And if you look at the forced labor side of it, which includes both sex slavery, what you might call it, sex trafficking at brothels or online, but also forced labor at factories and farms and brick kilns and fishing camps and other places, certain industries affect women in particular, like domestic workers, particularly in Africa. Say that I know there's a large migration of women from Zimbabwe to South Africa to work as maids. There's large migrations of women, say, from Ethiopia who move up to the Gulf states to work as maids. And almost always some form of sexual exploitation comes with the job.
That's Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme. Former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter was celebrated by her family and closest friends Wednesday at a private funeral in Plains, Georgia, the same tiny town where she and President Jimmy Carter were born. She was widely known for her global humanitarian work with her husband after they left the White House. VOA's Ken Farbo has been in the small town of Plains. I spoke with him earlier today about Mrs. Carter and the memorial services honoring her. So tell us about Rosalynn Carter and also a bit about her work in international healthcare issues and other causes.
Well, Rosalynn Carter, as First Lady of the United States, transformed the role of the wife of the President of the United States. She was someone who wanted to actively be involved in what her husband was doing, and she wanted to be knowledgeable about policy issues on behalf of the administration of the country. And so she asked her husband, Jimmy Carter, if she could join his cabinet meetings when she was First Lady. And, you know, she really set the stage for the activist role of the First Lady, the involved role of the First Lady, and she changed that role. Not only did she change the role of First Lady in the White House, she transformed the role of First Lady outside the White House. She has perhaps done more than any other First Lady prior to her, with the exception of perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt, in, as the Carter Center, which is the organization she founded, says, building hope, fighting disease. And what they do with the Carter Center and what Mrs. Carter is as a founder of that organization is helping to eradicate neglected tropical diseases like guinea worm, treating neglected tropical diseases like river blindness, promoting democracy, which would be the work in monitoring elections. And the cause of her life, she did this both in the White House and well beyond the White House, is addressing mental health issues, trying to remove the stigma associated with those who are dealing with mental health issues, and trying to promote treatments of those people who are suffering from mental health issues. And because of Rosalynn Carter, the world in general understands the issues of mental health illnesses and treating mental health much more because of her.
So what events are planned today there in Plains?
So today is the final day of memorial and tribute services to Mrs. Carter. This is the town in which she was born nearly a century ago, and this is the place she will be buried. And so today in the church that she has attended for the last 40-some years, close friends and family are paying tribute to her for a final memorial service. And as the memorial service concludes, the motorcade that's carrying her casket will drive to her home, which is just at the edge of the town of Plains, Georgia, and there will be a private burial service next to the pond that is in front of their house, and that is where Rosalynn Carter will be buried.
Ken Farbo in Plains, Georgia, updating us on the tribute ceremonies for former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Thanks for your input.
Thank you so much.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.